From NPR and WBUR, I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, the American Medical Association, the American Nurses Association, and more than 50 other healthcare groups sent out an urgent plea for COVID-19 vaccines to be mandated for all healthcare workers. New York City will require all city employees to be vaccinated by September 13th.
White House coronavirus advisor Dr. Anthony Fauci says the CDC is actively considering whether to revise mask guidelines for vaccinated people. Health officials are tracking thousands of new coronavirus cases every day in states where vaccination rates are low and the highly contagious Delta variant is spreading. That's places like Louisiana, which saw last week the largest jump in cases since the beginning of the pandemic. Joining us now is Dr. Catherine O'Neill, an infectious disease specialist at Our Lady of the Lake Hospital in Baton Rouge. Dr. O'Neill, your hospital announced a three-week pause on new non-urgent inpatient surgery. Why is that necessary?
Good morning. Yes, today we felt like it was necessary because we have 100 patients in the hospital today with COVID-19, 112 to be exact. And at that point, you just start to run out of beds for people who need care. So what's the easiest to put off? You can't put off anybody coming through your front door. And so you start to put off those things that could be put off for a couple of weeks, and that's elective cases. So we've done this for the last two surges. We try not to put off any necessary care for any long period of time, but this three-week pause will open up beds for other patients.
And is it possible that three-week pause could be extended?
Absolutely. Last summer, we did extend the pause. It lasted 5 to 6 weeks into August from July, and then started to add back certain types of cases as we freed up certain types of beds. So it'll be a week-by-week decision.
I understand that at your hospital, only about 61% of employees are vaccinated. I wonder if you support the call that we're now hearing for a mandate for vaccinations for healthcare workers.
Our entire medical community, I think from a physician standpoint and from a leadership standpoint, do support the recommendations. There is a big difference between supporting a recommendation and putting it into action, especially when that recommendation has to be reviewed by the authorities within the state. So we've seen lots of states, not Louisiana, try to block these initiatives. And at this point, I think it's just a matter of when. Not a matter of whether we will do it, but we want to make sure that we have the support from everybody before we pull that trigger.
Less than 40% of people who are eligible for vaccines in Louisiana are fully vaccinated. What do you think might work to help convince people to get their shot?
Some of the things that we have seen work in the last week, because we have seen more people get vaccinated and sign up for vaccinations in the last week than we had seen in the month of June, is talking about who this virus, this Delta virus, is infecting. I think that lots of people had preconceived notions about this wouldn't affect them, the pandemic was over, even the fact that maybe they've already been infected and so they were going to be okay. And so going through what we're seeing in the hospital, which is a much younger patient population, 45% of our admits are under the age of 50 today, mm-hmm. Going through what those clinical courses look like and what the risk factors are, it's just a very different virus from last summer, and we really need to communicate that to the people in our community to encourage them to get vaccinated.
And so we heard from the governor last week with updated guidance recommending that everybody, whether they're vaccinated or not, wear masks inside when they're not able to keep 6 feet of different distance between themselves and other people. How has this conversation gone over in the community around your hospital in Baton Rouge?
I think around the hospital it's gone well because we've remained masked. So our Department of Health has asked all hospital employees and people who work in healthcare to remain masked, even though the mask mandates were lifted for everybody else. It's an easier conversation to have. In the community, it really does depend on that sense of how much are you doing for your community? Do you feel like this is important? And that's why we keep talking about the message that it's incredibly important as an individual to have a community view of vaccination and of masking. This surge is everybody's job to get down, not just those people who are at risk. And I think that messaging is different from last summer, and it's something that we're really trying to get on board with. We're a great community. We really do pull together during times of crisis, and so we really need to understand that this is a community effort and not an individual effort.
So you have, I think you said, 100 patients with coronavirus in the hospital right now. What is worrying you the most? What's your biggest concern? Yeah.
Right. So what worries me the most are the things that we know about the current virus. So Delta virus, very different. It produces 1,000 times more virus in your nose, so you're much more infectious to the people around you. We're seeing the exponential growth of our inpatients over the last week. We've never seen that type of rate of admission in any of our surges. That worries me because we will get to overwhelmed capacity very quickly. And then the age. We have 10 admitted patients to our children's hospital today. We've never had that many children admitted with COVID-19 at one given time in this entire pandemic. We have 10 people in their 20s who have no underlying conditions or appeared to be very healthy from the outset who were admitted to our adult hospital today, and one 18-year-old. This is just a very different virus, and it's because of that infectiousness. I don't think people in the community right now understand that.
Or perhaps appreciate it. Catherine O'Neill is an infectious disease specialist at Our Lady of the Lake Hospital in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Thank you.
Well, to a story now about workers. When skilled professionals arrive in the U.S. as immigrants, refugees, or asylum seekers, many of them face barriers to re-entering their fields, a story of personal challenges, but also it has consequences for state economies. Take Maine. It struggles to retain skilled workers, while many foreign-trained professionals are stuck in entry-level jobs. A new law aims to close that gap, and from Maine Public Radio, Ari Snyder reports.
For as long as she can remember, Francine Gabu says she wanted to pursue a career in law, specifically so she could help other people.
Since I was a little girl, I was like one of these person who will just like step up for the weakest people. I was just like trying to defend others.
This was in Kinshasa, the capital city of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And sure enough, Gabu went on to earn a law degree and later became a judge. It was a career she loved, and while it wasn't the most lucrative job, it assured her a certain amount of respect in society. That all came to an abrupt halt when she fled the DRC in 2011. She says her work angered the political establishment there. She landed in Portland, Maine, and began her asylum process. In addition to the trauma of escaping her home country, she had to confront the sudden loss of a central part of her identity.
What was told around me is I have to forget that I was a lawyer. I have to forget that. I went to law school. The only thing I can do in this country will be to clean floors.
Gabu has company among countless highly qualified professionals who have arrived in the U.S. as immigrants, refugees, or asylum seekers, only to find themselves stuck in jobs far below their skill level.
There tends to be an immediate declassing when people come to Maine.
Stephanie Trice Gill is the founder of Intwork, a recruiting company that works closely with professionals arriving from other countries.
So it goes from, well, I'm a doctor or a surgeon in the Congo, to, oh, well, you're not a doctor here. Here's the shelter. You need to understand how things work.
Gill says barriers to entry for foreign-trained professionals push people to leave the state. When that happens, she says, nobody wins.
It's ironic because in Maine we have a desperate need for the people who are coming here. We have a desperate need for engineers, tech, healthcare professionals.
That irony is not lost on Celia Mantovani, a psychiatrist from Brazil who has struggled for years to get her medical credentials recognized.
Every time I hear, like, oh, we need psychiatrists so much in Maine. And I am here, and I keep thinking, oh my God.
Mantovani has a PhD, more than 2 decades of clinical experience, and her research has been published in multiple scientific journals. Still, to get a psychiatric license in the U.S., she would need to complete a medical residency. But she's been told she has too much experience to qualify for a residency.
It's always like what people say is a catch-22. So that's our situation. It's so frustrating.
Mantovani did have a breakthrough recently when she got certified as a counseling professional. It's not the full medical license she had in Brazil, but it was enough to land her counseling jobs at a school and a pediatric clinic. Many others, though, are still locked out of their fields, and a new state law aims to provide some relief.
It's exciting to me because it feels like a win-win for everybody.
State Representative Kristen Cloutier, a Democrat from Lewiston, sponsored the legislation, which gives state regulators greater flexibility in recognizing professional credentials from other jurisdictions, whether that's another state or another country. It also sets up a process for provisional licensing.
So if folks need a little bit more education in a certain area, they can be working while also receiving that education at the same time.
Maine's governor has signed the law, and state officials are now working out exactly how it will be implemented. In the meantime, Francine Gabu, the judge from Kinshasa, is restarting her law career through a job at the Immigrant Legal Advocacy Project. She's also completing an intensive legal training that will allow her to represent clients in immigration cases. She says it's hard to express how good it feels to be working again in her area of expertise.
I really love it. It's like me re-becoming myself.
She says her next project will be to get her law degree again. For Here and Now, I'm Ari Snyder in Portland, Maine.
The contrasts are startling. There's enough COVID vaccine in the U.S. to inoculate all eligible adults, teens, and adolescents several times over. Yet health officials here have to launch ad campaigns, knock on doors to convince people to get a shot. In other parts of the world, vaccines won't come for months or years. Here's Larry Modowo, a Kenyan man, speaking on CNN about recent deaths in his family.
I've kind of had this roller coaster of emotions between obviously heartbreak for losing family members, but also not just anger, outrage, because it was preventable. My uncle got COVID just last month and died within a few days. He didn't get vaccinated, so we can't help wondering if he did get a vaccine, maybe he would still be here. He was only in his 60s. He still had a whole life ahead of him.
And his grandmother is now on a ventilator, an item that is all too rare on the continent. Well, today we go to Africa, now experiencing its most deadly stage of the pandemic. New cases have been increasing for the last 2 months, and only a single percent of Africa's 1.3 billion people are fully vaccinated, as the Delta variant spreads quickly from country to country. For those who get COVID, at least one study shows people in Africa are more likely to die from its complications than patients in other parts of the world. In Zambia, only 0.4% of the population has been fully vaccinated. That's about 68,000 people out of nearly 18 million. Dr. Basim Berkland teaches medicine at the University of Zambia in Lusaka, where he also treats patients. He's affiliated with Seed Global Health, a not-for-profit that supports healthcare workers in developing countries. Dr. Berkland, welcome.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be on the program.
Well, it's an honor to speak with you. And we also want to bring in Dr. Vanessa Carey, a critical care physician at Mass General Hospital in Boston and co-founder of Seed Global Health. Dr. Carey, Vanessa, welcome to you as well.
Thank you very much.
What is the picture in Africa?
Well, Africa's really seeing now its greatest surge of COVID cases since the pandemic began. Unfortunately, as the Delta variant spreads, it's incredibly infectious and contagious. The reality, too, is that there is a dire shortage of resources on the continent to address COVID, as well as a complete paucity of vaccines with which to protect the healthcare workforce that is trying to address the COVID burden there. We're seeing unnecessary deaths, and very importantly, we're seeing a lot of healthcare workers be put at risk because they don't have the protections they need, they don't have the vaccines. You know, Uganda, in the last 2 weeks alone, lost 16 physicians to COVID.
Well, and Dr. Berkland, you're there in Lusaka, in Zambia. How has life changed there because of the pandemic? What does it feel like there? And what's going on in your hospital?
Well, like many countries in Africa, Zambia is facing a very serious third wave of COVID-19 that is both larger and more deadly than previous waves we've had. And this has put additional stress on an already struggling healthcare system. You know, in the past month, Zambia has recorded some of the highest numbers of new cases in Africa. The government converted several hospitals into COVID-19 treatment hospitals, and our facility was one of them. Within a very short time, we watched as the bed occupancy went up in our wards. The ripple effect is huge. So, for example, as a large general hospital, our facility normally provides services to hundreds of people every day. Routine childhood vaccinations, delivery of babies, HIV and tuberculosis clinics. So where does the woman that's 8.5 months pregnant go? And where does the malnourished child go to be weighed?
Yeah, well, and talk about the direct consequence of the surge. What's it like in the hospital? I mean, here in the U.S., we heard the beeping ventilators. We saw doctors and nurses in full hazmat. What's it like where you are?
These are large rooms with somewhere between 10 and 15 beds, very different to what you would see in the United States. Quite a small area with very few healthcare workers to look after them. And, you know, because of this, people are avoiding hospitals. They're presenting late with advanced COVID-19 infection. One patient we saw last week, he had been treated by relatives at home for several days using traditional remedies in fear that if he came to the hospital under those conditions, he would essentially lose contact with his family and never be discharged. And by the time he arrived at the hospital, he was so short of breath, we were not able to save him.
80%, we understand, of the deaths in Zambia are now COVID.
Yes. And in terms of the beeping machines and the sound of the ventilators, there's definitely not enough ventilators. But even if there was, we don't have sufficient number of healthcare workers with the advanced training and the skills to manage and use them as a life-saving intervention.
Well, this explains the death rate, too, going up. But are you vaccinated? Is your staff vaccinated? Because the population isn't vaccinated.
I am vaccinated along with a number of our medical residents, but not everyone is vaccinated and not all healthcare workers are vaccinated.
115,000 healthcare workers have actually died in the COVID pandemic. And while that number may seem not particularly large when you think about the number of people who've died globally, which is over 4 million, the reality is that's over a million years of schooling. And that's hundreds of millions of patients that won't get care in this crisis moment because of that loss. And so the impact is quite significant.
Well, Dr. Carey, talk about a couple of things we just heard. African countries are relying primarily on COVAX, the global partnership that was supposed to deliver free doses, but the current estimate is that only 7% of Africans will be vaccinated by October. Pfizer just announced an agreement with a South African vaccine manufacturer to handle final stages of production there, but that's only starting next year. Why aren't there more vaccines available for over a billion people?
There's a lot of complex reasons. It has to do with international trade laws that have put patents in place that globally exist. So even though there is manufacturing capacity around the world in multiple different countries, there is not necessarily the licensing to be allowed to produce those vaccines. But I think also there's been kind of a race and vaccine nationalism by certain countries that accrued huge stockpiles of vaccines and are slow to release them to the places that are hardest hit. But the truth is that even if we had enough vaccines, we don't have necessarily the health workforce to deliver those vaccines. So for every dollar of donated vaccine, there's $5 more needed to deliver that vaccine, and $2.50 of that is just in healthcare workforce training and sort of support of the healthcare workers to do that. And so now there's been a system of pulling healthcare workers from other services to deliver vaccines, but then that means that women don't have somebody attending them in childbirth. We're not providing essential primary care. And there's been a number of studies that have shown there's been disruption of HIV/AIDS services. Lancet just came out with a study that showed that global and maternal fetal outcomes have actually worsened. So we know that there is a deep crisis looming. We can choose to invest in the fundamental structures to deliver better health, which is the healthcare workers, and that those healthcare workers can not only help us address COVID, but they can also outlast the pandemic to deliver the essential services and be ready for the next pandemic.
Well, Dr. Berkman, there in Zambia, what's the conversation when you hear that here in the United States, there are people who think vaccines are a hoax? I know there have been questions across the continent about different vaccines as well, but here in the U.S., we have surplus vaccines. The government's mounting huge campaigns, going door to door, trying to convince people to get the shot.
Unfortunately, this is really where we're at right now, and it's extremely inequitable, the distribution of vaccines. To date, less than 1% of our population has been vaccinated in Zambia. Many of these are high-risk healthcare workers still working unprotected.
Dr. Carey, when you talk about things that need to change, what has to change? You know, governments, you know, deciding that they're going to help. What has to change?
Well, I think there has to be truly, I think, a fundamental value shift of what we want to invest in as a global population. And there are countries that have led on this, really invested in health and well-being and poverty reduction. But I think that COVID has really demonstrated the absolute power and influence that health has on our everyday activities. It's the difference between whether or not we live in poverty and our ability to go to work, whether our children go to school, whether we have economic growth and development or even have security. And so if we take that lens, investing in health should be one of the greatest and biggest priorities that we make. Last year, billionaires made an additional $1.9 trillion or something in that range. As we have a race to space right now between two billionaires, that money alone could be transformative for health outcomes for people around the world, because no one is safe until we're all safe.
And I ask you just briefly, your thoughts, your eye on Africa, hearing people here turn away the vaccines that they desperately need in Africa.
It is deeply painful to think about the deep need for vaccines. And so to see the surplus of vaccines not being shared globally is incredibly difficult. And to see people who have the opportunity to take a vaccine, which is life-saving, choose not to, is very difficult. We are in a global crisis, and we need to think about how do we collaborate globally to change the trajectory of this pandemic.
Dr. Vanessa Carey, co-founder of Seed Global Health, the not-for-profit that focuses on supporting and training healthcare workers in developing nations, and Dr. Basim Berkland, who practices and teaches medicine in Lusaka, Zambia. Thank you both so much, and best to you in your work.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And for more information on Seed Global Health and its work in sub-Saharan Africa, go to hereandnow.org.
Good question.
That's a really good question.
It's a great question.
This is free therapy.
Thank you for asking me that.
God, that's such a good question.
That's an interesting question.
But what Fresh Air interviews are really about are the interesting answers. Listen and subscribe to Fresh Air from WHYY and NPR.
Shockwaves rippled through the gaming industry last week when California's Department of Fair Employment and Housing filed a gender bias lawsuit against Activision Blizzard. That's the company behind worldwide hits like World of Warcraft, Call of Duty, and Overwatch. The lawsuit describes a frat house culture where women were paid less, fired sooner, belittled, harassed, and retaliated against. Now, many of the company's own employees are speaking out against it, and some players are protesting by staging virtual sit-ins. We'll get more details now from Bloomberg Technologies' Jason Schreier.
Hi, Celeste. Thank you so much for having me.
So when you looked over the lawsuit, what details jumped out at you?
Yeah, there's a lot in here. Everything from sexual discrimination and discrimination against pregnant employees to women saying they felt like they couldn't advance or get raises within the company without cozying up to their male managers to some more serious allegations like physical sexual harassment. One person in particular is accused of what the suit refers to as a hotel suite nicknamed the Cosby Suite after alleged rapist Bill Cosby. Some really rough stuff in here.
The company did issue an apology that did not go over well. Why?
There were a couple of letters that went out. One was from the president of Blizzard, which was kind of received with an overall shrug, I would say. And then what made things worse was a letter from an Activision executive named Fran Townsend, who joined the company just a few months ago. She was previously, interestingly enough, Homeland Security Advisor to George W. Bush. And she essentially said that the lawsuit was bunk and wrong and said that Activision was a great place to work, which really, I think, upset a lot of Blizzard employees who had seen and heard a lot of this stuff firsthand.
And we have heard from employees. Jeff Hamilton, who's a senior system designer on World of Warcraft, has been relatively vocal and tweeted out, "I can tell you almost no work is being done on World of Warcraft right now while this obscenity plays out, and that benefits nobody." Is there a work stoppage?
Not quite yet. There are rumblings that people at the company might start to take some sort of action soon, but I've seen dozens of current Blizzard employees speak out and say, "Hey, this Activision statement does not speak for me. Now that this stuff has been exposed, it can't be hidden for any longer. The company can't pretend it doesn't exist. The company is almost going to be forced to take these things seriously."
So how does this connect to, people maybe remember, Gamergate? That was an online harassment campaign in 2014 and 2015. 2015, in which women were harassed, especially female gaming journalists. Mm-hmm. And people have said because when these issues have arisen in the past and they have not been dealt with decisively, that's how we got to where we are today. What do you think is the connection?
Yeah, I think overall it's very safe to say that video game culture is just full of toxicity, whether it's an online voice chat on Call of Duty or it's the company themselves. The lawsuit, for example, says that Blizzard has 20% female employees, which I think really says a lot. And I think that the common thread you see between Gamergate and gaming culture in general, where women that I've spoken to, I mean, have to like avoid using voice chat because they know they'll get harassed. Just a horrible atmosphere that the game companies really have not taken responsibility with dealing with, and they've all kind of just stayed silent and allowed this toxicity to fester, both within their companies and outside of their company.
Yeah, I'm a gamer. I can speak to that toxicity myself, and I should point out that women account for more than 40% of gamers, so it's, you know, not entirely men who are players. Bloomberg Technologies' Jason Schreier, thank you so much.
Yep, thanks for having me, Sloss.
A top U.S. diplomat is in China today for talks covering a variety of issues, including North Korea. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman met with Japanese and South Korean officials last week, talking about restarting nuclear talks, and that's something North Korea has so far refused to do. NPR international correspondent Anthony Kuhn joins us now from Seoul. Hi, Anthony.
Hello, Celeste.
I don't mean to diminish something which our president has called our biggest foreign policy threat, but it does feel like every time we talk about North Korea and nuclear talks, we have to do a recap, sort of a previously on North Korea nuclear talks. Can you bring us up to date?
Yes. Well, talks with North Korea have been stalled since the abortive summit between then-President Trump and Kim Jong-un in Vietnam in 2019. When the Biden administration came to office, they conducted a policy review to decide what they wanted to do. And they came out saying that what they want to offer is a so-called calibrated and practical approach to diplomacy. And what they mean by that is, unlike the Trump administration, which was angling for a sort of grand bargain in a high-stakes summit setting, the Biden administration is going to go from the bottom up, in which each side gives a concession, gets a concession, confidence is built, and the talks move ahead towards eventual denuclearization. As you said, Deputy Secretary Wendy Sherman has been in the region this week, and she re-upped the U.S.'s what she called sincere offer of talks without preconditions. She said that North Korea is, like everyone else, dealing with COVID and so may be slow to respond, and so the U.S. needs to show patience, but maybe not too much patience.
I wonder, the North, we haven't heard a response on that offer to meet anywhere, anytime, without precondition. But the North has said it wants a drawdown to U.S. hostility. What kind of information do we have about what North Korea wants?
Well, the U.S. has already said it's willing to meet anytime, anywhere. And North Korea was extremely dismissive with its foreign minister, saying they're not even considering the possibility of contact with the U.S. When they say they want an end to U.S. hostile policies, they're talking about an end to U.S.-South Korean joint military exercises. They also want sanctions relief. The U.S. says it will keep the sanctions in place, although it has expressed support for letting humanitarian aid in. Of course, the North Koreans would like to see even more, such as the withdrawal of U.S. troops from South Korea and getting rid of the new U.S. nuclear umbrella, which protects the South, but there's no sign that that's on the table.
So as we mentioned, Wendy Sherman is in China today. How successful is the U.S. at this point at getting China to pressure North Korea to come back to the table?
Well, what Sherman said is that North Korea is one area where the U.S. and China share interests and they should find ways to cooperate. It's true that they both want to see the Korean Peninsula free of nuclear weapons, but the confrontation at this point between Washington and Beijing is so heated, it's not clear that North Korea is very high on the agenda or that Beijing is willing to help. China's foreign ministry said today that they see the U.S.-China relationship in crisis, that it's the U.S.'s fault, and the U.S. must fix this by stopping criticism of China's handling of various issues, including Taiwan, Hong Kong, the South China Sea, Xinjiang, and also the origins of the coronavirus. So it doesn't look like North Korea is very high on either side's list of talking points.
Although, to put some perspective on the stakes here, as I mentioned, President Biden has called North Korea the biggest foreign policy threat facing the U.S. right now. What exactly does the Biden administration see as North Korea's threat?
Well, their nuclear arsenal just keeps getting bigger and bigger. They keep on developing other conventional weapon systems. They probably have now anywhere from 20 to 60 nuclear weapons. And recent history shows that when they don't get attention and they're low on the agenda, they have a way of grabbing attention by launching military provocations. They haven't tested any nuclear weapons or ICBM tests since 2017. But as Kim Jong-un has said, that's a unilateral, self-imposed sort of moratorium, and they don't have to continue to honor it. And so they have plenty of newly developed weapon systems, such as, for example, submarine-launched ballistic missiles, which they're ready to test when they feel it could get them some good results.
NPR's Anthony Kuhn in Seoul, thanks so much.
Thank you, Celeste.
Well, we just mentioned China, whose ruling Communist Party mounted a revolution, then won a civil war more than 70 years ago. These days, on the eve of its 100th birthday, the Communist Party is trying to keep its revolutionary spirit alive by sending its cadres or members to party history boot camp. Yes, NPR's Emily Fang visited one of these elite party academies and brings us this story.
The director of the Yan'an Executive Leadership Academy strolls through its sandy-colored campus. Its arches are designed to mimic the caves carved straight into the cliffs that communist soldiers lived in for 13 years here while headquartered in Yan'an City. The party fled here in the 1930s after a grueling journey on foot. It used the remoteness of Yan'an for protection against the Japanese and to regroup so they could best a rival political party later on. Nearby, about 40 cadres unfold little plastic stools outside a cave Chairman Mao Zedong once lived in. They're getting a lecture today on how the chairman won support from the people of Yan'an in the 1930s. The pedagogical style is somewhere in between that of a Bible study and that of a business school. It's an honor to be plucked out of the Chinese Communist Party's roughly 90 million members and invited to the Leadership Academy. The idea is to use case studies drawn from party mythology to inspire present-day members. I came here to charge my batteries, says Song Jiazhong, meaning to invigorate his belief in the party. Song normally writes policy as a mid-level party official with the Heilongjiang provincial government, but he's taking time off for a two-week refresher course on what the party calls the spirit of Yan'an, shorthand for frugality and dedication to the common people.
Studying our revolutionary ancestors stimulates our motivation for work and strengthens our sense of responsibility and our sense of meaning.
There are three such executive leadership academies across China. Yan'an was chosen as one because it was the Communist Party's wartime capital. Each of these three academies specializes in using the surrounding region's history to create crash courses in communist management theory, teaching a curriculum akin to the seven habits of successful cadres, if you will. One of these habits, work harder. Here's Zhou Shanshan, a cadre who's done two stints at the academy.
The Communist Party grew strong while headquartered in Yan'an, despite the horrible and arduous living conditions here. We need to recapture that original spirit of wholehearted service.
Another good habit, the people's interests come first. Instructor Wang Zhongcheng offers this example of Mao's cadres, who, in the 1930s, heard that one particular Yan'an village was chronically ill from dirty water.
The communist cadres immediately put down their guns and walked dozens of miles to find a clean water source and channel it to the village. The villagers were so happy Chairman Mao had not forgotten the poor.
And the most important habit of all, never doubt the Communist Party. Here's instructor Feng Jianmei.
The party was founded during one of China's most difficult times. It led its people on a unique path that it carved out for itself through a century of struggle.
Admittedly, the party's history may not be incredibly useful for modern-day governing, but for many far-flung cadres, the academy's most important function is actually to get a sense of what top leaders in Beijing want from them, and to rekindle the spiritual fire that inevitably diminishes with time. Professor Wang Zhongcong has dedicated his entire life to parsing party history, and for him, it's become a guiding light on how to live his life.
Your body can join the party, but it's your soul that also should join the party. The latter requires you to embody the party's mission and character. This requires a lifetime of self-cultivation to reach the ultimate requirement, sacrificing everything at a moment's notice for the party and for the people.
All of this sounds great on paper, of course, and the communists did win a civil war, then maintain their control over a one-party state. But the task of running that state and managing 1.4 billion people, that remains their biggest challenge. Emily Fang, NPR News, Yan'an, China.
A towering civil rights figure has died. Bob Moses' father was a janitor who gave him books. Bob became an intellectual 25-year-old with a degree in philosophy from Harvard, who taught at a private school in New York. But when he began to follow newspaper accounts of sit-ins in the South, decided he had to go there.
I mean, it was dramatic in the sense that I was there the summer before the Freedom Rides in 1960 and came back in the summer of 61 after the rides had landed. And the difference in just how a young kid would look at me walking the street, right? I mean, they knew I wasn't from their little town.
But they came to know Bob Moses. He became a leader in voter registration drives and later saw math as a tool for struggling communities, founding the Algebra Project. Not as well known as Martin Luther King, certainly, or others, he was a hero to many, including the president of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, Freeman Hrubowski, a mathematician himself. President Hrubowski, a personal loss for you. We're very sorry. And remind us why he was your hero.
Sure. Here's a man who was living in New York in a very privileged situation, who realized that he was needed around the country, who goes to Mississippi to register voters. And he's someone who understood the power of education to make a difference, to transform lives. And he went and spent his life doing just that, first in civil rights, and then making this amazing connection between civil rights and mathematics.
Well, I want to stay with his early 60s work because while he maybe didn't sit in at the lunch counter, what he did do, and you mentioned voter registration, was teach young African Americans how to pass what were incredibly stringent voter literacy tests. I mean, that's where he saw his power. And later in 64, he helped organize the Mississippi Freedom Summer Project. This was bringing hundreds of white college student volunteers to help with that voter drive. And of course, three of them, Michael Schwerner, James Cheney, and Andrew Goodman, were murdered. I mean, sure. He himself, Bob Moses, was assaulted. So talk more about that.
Right. I mean, he was someone who was well-educated and who understood that he needed to help people to learn to think critically. So when you talk about helping with voter registration and dealing with literacy tests, you're talking about somebody who's teaching. And most important, he was preparing people to pass those tests and to go and register and bringing people from other parts of the country to understand the challenges that Black people in the South were facing.
Yeah, and a great danger, as we just underscored.
Exactly. And keep in mind that he was not somebody simply in a classroom. He was somebody who was being physically damaged as a result of everything from having been hit in the head with a knife handle all the way to being in a car where people had been shot. So he was of great courage and at the same time was very understated. There was nothing glitzy about Bob Moses. He was brain power and compassion.
Talk about the Algebra Project. This is connecting students to daily tasks that might translate into math and talk about it.
Anybody, I'm a mathematician, anybody in STEM has to get goosebumps thinking about Bob Moses making the connection between mathematics and life. And that's what he was doing. He was understanding that if children didn't get the basic algebraic skills and skills before the algebra in order to consider what they might want to do in life, they would be left out of so many opportunities. And so he was bringing innovation to algebra in a special way and saying that Black people can do algebra, Black people can do mathematics at a time when so many Americans still today will say, I can't do math. His message for all Americans was, yes, you can do math and math can help you to succeed in life.
Yeah. By the way, can you give us an example of how,
I mean, when you think about, you think just today, if we're interviewing for 15 minutes from 11:15 until 11:30, and my next interview starts at 11:45, how much time do I have between the interviews? I mean, the idea of thinking about real life problems and being able to use math calculations to solve and to figure out what you're going to do is the absolute best of math literacy. It is believing that being able to read and think critically will be a part of problem solving, whether in math or in life, the algebra project.
Doing voter registration himself, bringing hundreds of young whites who would follow him anywhere to the South, where some lost their lives. He inspired that. And teaching kids through math, big life.
Yes. And he taught us how to think critically and how to imagine the possibilities. Nobody had talked about Blacks in math before, or Americans in math, and the connection of civil rights and math. As a child leader in the civil rights movement myself in Birmingham, it was the math and listening to Dr. King that led me to know how important it is for children to be empowered to solve problems. That's what Bob Moses did. He inspired me and so many other people.
Sreeman Rubowski, a mathematician and president of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, reflecting on his friend and hero, as he said, the civil rights icon Bob Moses, who died yesterday. Freeman, President Rubowski, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Celeste Headlee. It's Here and Now.